Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with the support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Governor Andy Beshear joins us from his office in Frankfort, where the 2020 session of the Kentucky General Assembly is now underway. We want to thank you for taking a few minutes out of a busy, busy schedule to talk with us here on Eastern Standard, Governor Beshear.
Well, I'm excited to be able to be on, to talk to all of those Kentuckians that you reach, and to continue to spread the message that we are all in this together, that we are all on Team Kentucky, and this is our opportunity to show that neighbors can talk to neighbors, that we can move forward where there is common ground, and where we disagree, we can do it civilly like adults.
Well, Governor, you just delivered your first State of the Commonwealth address. What has made your short list of legislation that you hope to see pass this year?
Well, in the State of the Commonwealth, we talked primarily not just about pieces of legislation that we want to pass, but how we should go about these sessions and governance, not just this year, but every year thereafter. And that's about ultimately living by that golden rule, that we treat our neighbors as ourselves, and everybody is our neighbor, including someone in a different branch of government or in a different political party. And so while I hope that we can accomplish a lot in this legislative session, the way we go about it, the way we talk to each other, proving that we can disagree on a Tuesday but come together and do something important on a Wednesday, that's going to be just as important as everything else. Because if we can prove that we can do that, we won't just have a good session this year. We'll have a better one the next year and a better one the year after. So a lot of this session is going to come down to the budget. We've got to put together a $40 billion budget for the next two fiscal years. Those start in July. Of the Commonwealth. And while we're going to have lots of opportunity, and we're going to be able to stop the backwards momentum we've had in so many different areas, we're going to be able to invest in education. We also are going to have to come to grips with the fact that we have one of the highest incarceration rates in the country and truly in the world, and that we are rapidly coming to a decision about whether or not we want to continue to incarcerate people at the rate we are or educate our children, because those dollars that it's going to take to continue with the incarceration rate we have are coming directly from other needs that are so important.
Well, you inherit a situation in which state budget officials recently said that they expect Kentucky to collect additional revenue that falls quite short of the state's estimated $1.8 billion, I believe it is, in new spending obligations, things like the pension, Medicaid, public employee, retiree health insurance. And even so, there are some mighty big asks out there. You mentioned education. So the Pritchard Committee, for example, is calling for $1 billion in additional investment in education over 6 years. Should these and other expectations be tempered by the realities of the day?
Well, the realities are that we have a limited number of dollars to spend, and what that means is we have to lead by our values. While we certainly don't have $1 billion extra to put into education in this coming biennium, I believe that people will see a significant investment and reinvestment into public education and higher education. Every year that we shortchange our system of education, it's a generation of kids that pay for it. Number one on that list is stopping a teacher shortage that has our kids in important and fundamental classes, certain years of reading or algebra, where so many classes that are going to occur years to come build off of. You shouldn't have a year-long sub for something like that. Having a shortage in so many of the areas of science that are critical that we teach in Kentucky ultimately shortchanges our children and impacts the education they get. So what people can absolutely expect to see in our budget is a $2,000 across-the-board raise to our teachers that I talked about during my election. That's not about paying anybody back, because our teachers are very much underpaid. It is about ending a teacher shortage that threatens the education of our kids and the future of the Commonwealth.
So you were sworn in on December 10th. The legislature went into session barely 30 days later, and so you had to hit the ground running. And, and with an agenda that in some areas, for example, the teacher pay raise that might run counter to that of the General Assembly's Republican supermajorities in each House, does that reality make it more likely that you'll consider signing rather than vetoing some Republican-backed initiatives?
Well, you started off talking about how we hit the ground running, and that's certainly what happens when you become governor. You're sworn in. For me, it was December 10th. You have a $40 billion budget you got to provide a month and a half later. You got to build the administration around you. It's kind of like flying an airplane while it's still being built. But I am excited about this opportunity. I'm approaching every day with enthusiasm and optimism. I believe we're going to be able to craft a state budget that leads by our values, that invests in our future, and ultimately serves the mission that we have in this office, and that is to make long-term change that not only betters the lives of this generation of Kentucky families, but everyone after. We're talking about it right now as the where we're going. The each letter of where standing for something important. The W is for wages at a time of low unemployment. In some areas, though we certainly have work to do in Eastern Kentucky, what we absolutely have to do is raise the wages of our jobs so no one has to work two or three just to get by. The H is health care, because everybody should be able to take their parents or kids to see a doctor when they're sick. The E is education and the investment we need. The R is retirements, protecting retirements for those that have been promised a pension, but also encouraging the type of investment that, people need to make around Kentucky to live out their senior years. And the last E is example, in setting that type of example that Kentuckians can be proud of. And so any bill that comes to us, we're going to look through that lens. Certainly my goal is to find common ground and move forward. Now, we will all hit certain issues where we have convictions and values that lead us to disagree, but we're going to disagree like adults.
Senate leaders have labeled a bill that would prohibit the creation of sanctuary cities in Kentucky Senate Bill 1, and that's the designation that they give to their top priority legislation. It would also prevent public colleges and universities from enacting, adopting, or enforcing any quote-unquote sanctuary policies. What's your position on this?
Well, right now, Kentucky has no sanctuary cities. I know that because as Attorney General, I had to ensure that there were no sanctuary cities and certify it for the federal government so we could receive important dollars to, especially drug task forces all over Kentucky. So what we're doing right now is, we're reviewing any and all pieces of legislation that come in. And for everybody that's out there, the wording of these can be incredibly important. Sometimes they can set unfunded mandates. Sometimes they can create unintended consequences. So we're just taking that one and we're looking it over and making sure that we understand everything that's intended, but also everything that would happen that might not be intended.
Had you hoped that education funding would top the list of priorities?
Well, education funding is going to top my budget bill. And so I know that it will be a major topic in this session.
Okay. I'm wondering if you favor any gun-related legislation this session.
Well, on the campaign trail, I was very clear that I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I do believe that we ought to have a discussion around a red flag law. And what most people don't get is the true and honest information on that law. It's a law supported by President Donald Trump. It's a law that has been passed in Florida and a version in Indiana and is going through in Ohio. And basically, all it is designed to do is when we know those moments where somebody is about to walk into a school or a place of business and cause an amount of harm and carnage that can never be undone, that our law enforcement can step in and do something about it. I think that's a conversation that we need to have. But nobody out there needs to be worried about anybody coming and infringing on their rights. I believe in that Second Amendment, and it's going to be protected.
The new House Minority Floor Leader, Joni Jenkins, has said the Democrats' platform includes looking at casinos, sports wagering, legalizing and taxing medical marijuana. How much, if any, of these bills can be passed this session, do you think?
Well, I believe right now that sports betting has a lot of momentum behind it. It has bipartisan support, and I believe it has support across all regions in Kentucky. What it would do is it would take something that people already do, though oftentimes through a black market, bring it into a regulated entity that can make sure nobody goes too far. And depending on how it's done, we could secure between $20 and $40 million a year to help with important things we got to fund in the Commonwealth. And I'll give you an example on how to compare that. New textbooks for our kids statewide cost $17 million a year. Hmm. So when you look at something like sports betting and the revenue it can generate, what you also have to look at is the good that it can do with that revenue. And I tell you, we can stop a lot more problem gambling if we're able to bring it into a legal and regulated environment. I believe medicinal marijuana has significant support. You know, being the former top prosecutor, it took me a while to come to where I am, which is in full support of medicinal marijuana. It was, for me, it's because of the scourge of opioids. We have so many chronic pain patients that I believe plateau on opioids that they don't help them anymore, but their medicine cabinets are growing by the day in dangerous substances that, if stolen or if somebody takes, can cause accidental addiction. We see it all throughout Kentucky. What this allows is for people to get real pain relief and for us to lessen the flow of opioids, which is an important thing we have to achieve here in Kentucky.
Is that the basis for advancing medicinal marijuana? I'm neither pro nor con, but we did recently interview Shana Babylonis, who is a leading researcher at the University of Kentucky, and she researches both medical marijuana and opioids. And her conclusion was that medical marijuana really isn't a substitute for opioids when it comes to the relief of chronic pain.
Well, I believe that what we would see is a number of practitioners that would lessen the number of opioids they prescribe, which we're working on every single day before this. But I believe that medicinal marijuana is already in so many states. It is going to happen ultimately nationwide. I believe, as a former attorney general, as a top law enforcement agent in Kentucky, that I can do it responsibly, that we make sure that every prescription is real and not just someone wanting to smoke marijuana, and that we regulate how it's sold and where it's sold. I believe we can do it in a safe, reliable way. And I also think that it will create some revenue that we can use for good things.
You've been taking some executive actions that don't require legislative approval. And among them is to carry forward a program from the previous administration that covers the fee to take the GED for thousands of Kentuckians who did not graduate from high school. Why did you feel it important to continue funding this program?
Well, first, let me say that whether a program was started in the past administration, it doesn't come into any of my decision-making. A good program is a good program. We will continue things that work. We'll change things that don't, because my obligation isn't about my predecessor. It's about what's best for the people of Kentucky. So this is a really exciting program. We've got over 300,000 Kentuckians over 18 that don't have a high school diploma or a GED. And for half of those, that prevents them from coming into the workforce. They want to, but without securing that level of education or that certificate, they can't get a job they want. For so many others, it keeps them from getting a better job. And what we have seen is one of the biggest impediments, one of the main things that stops people from taking the test is its cost. A number of years ago, the way you take the test changed, but the fees also changed. So what we've done is provide $600,000 that will let at least 5,000 Kentuckians take the test and have their fee waived. Think about that, 5,000 Kentuckians that couldn't get into the workforce that can get into it, or 5,000 that can now get a better job. I will tell you, I have a friend that works in a community, one that we need to lift up, and the day we announced it, had somebody come in and sign up for the program. Now, if we want to be everything we want to be in Kentucky, we got to break cycles of poverty. We got to give people opportunity, and for everybody who makes it, it means that their kids and their kids' kids will have a better life. If we can focus on that, if we can focus on lifting people up, then our potential is so great in this state.
Governor Beshear, many of those people are in our coverage area, which encompasses eastern Kentucky, as you know. And the region has, of course, been experiencing some pretty serious challenges for a long time now, but much of that traces to the economic impact of declining coal revenues and employment. Some see salvation in growing a tourism economy and entrepreneurialism, that sort of thing. Others are working to attract new industry. What's your vision for the future of Appalachian Kentucky?
My vision for Appalachian Kentucky is a diversified, booming economy where the kids growing up have opportunity and even have choices within that opportunity. And to do that's going to take investment and vision. Investment in our infrastructure. The Mountain Parkway is something that I'm going to ensure that we speed up so that we can provide more opportunity to those communities that are off it or that are close to it. We still have so many areas that are struggling with sewer and water issues. Now, we have to make sure that every single community has clean drinking water, not just for our families, but also to attract the businesses that need to come there. We need to take advantage of agritech, a booming industry throughout the country that's going to be one of the most important moving forward worldwide. We have App Harvest in Moorhead that's going to be one of the largest agritech projects that we've seen, but there are so many smaller versions we can do and so many small businesses that we can create around it. And on tourism, we want to bring a vision that is created not just out of my office, but with people all over the Commonwealth, especially in Eastern Kentucky involved, where we can turn tourism and hospitality into a career path, where you can start waiting tables at a state park and you can see a future and get the training to manage a large-scale operation in the future. If we can do that, if we can build up those opportunities, then we will attract more tourists. We will bring more dollars into the state, but we'll also provide more opportunity in eastern Kentucky and outside of it.
Well, Governor Beshear, thank you so much for carving out a little bit of time for us on what I know is a very busy day, and we appreciate you visiting here on Eastern Standard.
Well, I appreciate y'all, and let me say to all your listeners, I'm honored to serve as their governor. I love serving as their governor, whether they voted for me or not. I am going to give it my all every single day, and I'm going to be the type of governor they can be proud of.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We are all connected, like the links in an unbroken chain. Each time we hurt someone or something, there's a part of us that feels the pain.
We're joined by Lexington Mayor Linda Gorton. She's completed her first year in office, and we invited her to stop by Eastern Standard to share what's crowding her plate these days. And we thank you for coming in, Mayor Gorton.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
So you're now preparing to give the mayor's annual State of the City speech later in the month on the 21st, and that will be followed in the spring by your budget address. I know it would be premature to tell us now what you'll be saying when you make these key speeches, but I wanted to ask you, does the speech writing process help you clarify your priorities and focus on what you're doing?
It definitely does, and it really focuses me and helps me clarify issues and priorities, and we work on this for almost a month before. And that's really good because the citizens want to understand what the government's priorities are. And it also kind of sets expectations, you know, mm-hmm. if I can put out to them, here are some things we see this year coming up.
And that expectation part is really important. I'm mm-hmm. sure you have to really think through what you can really deliver on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And we're just now starting to work on next year's budget. That'll be fiscal year 21. And many people will remember that our current budget under which we're operating right now, we had to cut 15% across the board, and we still had an $11 million gap. So then we cut further. And, you know, everything is rising in cost, as you know and citizens know. Cost of things are not going down, and our revenues are gradually falling.
And why are revenues falling?
Well, it's an interesting situation because we're almost at full employment. I think Fayette County right now is 2.8%, lowest we've ever been. So that means businesses are at full employment. We believe that because we're so heavily dependent on the payroll tax, the occupational license fee, and the net profits tax, that many businesses are not giving raises, which we always depend on raises to up that revenue. And they're not hiring because they're fully built out with employees. So we're working really hard to bring new jobs here. It's such an interesting phenomena because the economy seems to be just ticking along. And if you've talked to any investment folks lately, the stock market's high. It's an interesting, unique situation, but we're heavily dependent on that occupational license fee. And so in a case like this, it's hurting us.
I think one of the first things that comes to many a citizen's mind is the safety of a city.
Mm-hmm.
And crime is on a lot of people's minds these days, especially gun violence.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually goes to the budget. Are we able to police our city adequately in light of the crime that we're experiencing? There does seem to be a lot of shooting going on lately.
It's interesting that you ask me this because just today I attended our monthly what's called CompStat meeting. It's all the law enforcement folks,
mm-hmm.
local, state, federal, all that we have here in Lexington, we all gather together and hear the latest.
I've been to one of those. It's fascinating.
Okay. It is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And in today's report, we were told that overall, crime is down. Now, we know that the homicide number is up by one from last year, but the overall crime is down. And we have seen an increase in just random shooting, people who think it's fun to go out and shoot. They're not particularly aiming at anything, but of course it's dangerous.
I wish we could expand on each of these questions. I really do, because it's so mm-hmm. interesting and it's our community.
Yes.
But I want to cover as many bases as I can. So I want to move on to recycling, which also is on a lot of people's minds.
Yes.
And as I understand it, things are happening on that front.
Yes. And I get asked about recycling everywhere I go. People care a lot about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a problem initially with getting clean paper to recycle. People don't realize that when we mix in our recycling, sometimes things leak out of cans or they leak out of detergent bottles or whatever, and it was contaminating our paper. So our sources for recycling were drying up. They don't want contaminated paper. We did a pilot inside government and learned that we can get a clean paper stream. And so that's completed. And now we are moving on to the next step, which we'll be able to announce toward the end of January.
Another big issue that goes to the environment, and that has to do with our consent decree with the EPA to fix our storm and sanitary sewer systems. Where are we on that?
Well, as you know, Charlie Martin heads up that program. He's our director of Division of Water Quality, and he's awesome. And the water quality folks continue to work through those improvements that we're required to do to comply with the consent decree. And we're making great progress. And that's why people see lots of digging around town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every now and then I hear somebody say, well, I'm tired of all this digging. The digging represents improvement, and people need to keep that in mind. The other thing I wanted to mention with that is with the consent decree, a lot of it had to do with sewer overflows. And so they're fixing loads of pipes underground and all kinds of infrastructure. But we need the people, the citizens, to help. And the way they can help is don't put any grease ever down your sink. We can put all the new pipes in we want, but if people pour grease down their sink, it clogs the pipes. Mm. And they eventually will overflow. And also, when people are planting, you know, trees and shrubs and things, tree roots can get in and interfere with sewer pipes. So there are things like that that are important to do all the time.
So the state legislature is underway right now, the 2020 General Assembly, and the Senate leadership has announced that their designation of Senate Bill 1 this year, which is their priority legislation, has to do with illegal immigration. And specifically, this bill would prohibit the creation of sanctuary cities in Kentucky. And I'm wondering what your position is on that legislation.
Well, people need to understand Lexington's not a sanctuary city. We never have been. And the policies we follow in working with our federal partners have been in place for 20 years. We continue to do the same things that we have done for these last 20 years, and that is we do work with our federal partners. The city is not authorized to carry out and enforce federal policy. Most people understand that. So if the federal partners, and there are many of them, request our assistance, we give it. And we follow the law on that. Our police provide assistance when it's requested. So it's really critical to me as the leader of our growing city that this work well, because there are federal laws, there are state laws, and there are local laws. And so this is how we do it here. And this is how we have done it. Now, I will tell you, at the detention center, the jail, mm-hmm. when people are booked into the jail, every person who's arrested and taken there is asked where they were born. And the federal agencies have access to that information. Hmm. So we follow the law.
Okay, we're running out of time, but we have a lot of things to talk about here. So I want to try to get at least a couple of them in. And one of them is something that you just rolled out, which is a new app-based opioid education and prevention campaign for teens.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes. It's called FEND, and I love the acronym FEND. It stands for Full Energy, No Drugs. I love that. Hmm. Full Energy, No Drugs. And it's a Preventum Initiative is the name of the folks who do it. And, you know, we have grants for treatment. We have grants for recovery. We still need primary education, particularly with teenagers. We learned that when teens go to a party or go to some group activity and they're new, the first thing they're asked is whether they do drugs by their peers. I mean, think about that. I don't think you and I had to deal with that growing up. And they immediately are categorized that way. And so this tool will be on cell phones. They can get the app on their cell phone, and most teenagers have a cell phone. And it will have lots of information about drugs, about overdose. What do you do if one of your friends overdoses? It's all about educating them and giving them alternative ideas. Because teenagers, let's face it, they're vulnerable. They're mm-hmm. at a vulnerable age. So we're pretty excited about it. And what we want to do is stop drug use. We want to get to them before it ever starts.
Sure. And I mentioned opioids in the
yes.
in the question, but is this drugs in general?
Yes. Uh-huh. I mean, it happens that opioids, of one of which is heroin, are the the thing now that we're dealing with. Meth is on the rise, mm-hmm. and it will be something different in the future. But, you know, this resiliency to understand drugs and understand how to combat these things is really important because it will translate to other drugs too.
Before I let you go, I got to bring up something that I know was of interest to you before you even decided to run for mayor.
Yes. What is that?
And we were talking about Dr. Pierce Lyons' idea. The late Dr. Pierce Lyons advocated for Lexington to become an agricultural technology hub.
Yes.
Because we have the parts here.
Yes.
And you picked that up. Where does that stand?
I did. I picked that up long before I, you know, ran, because I heard him speak about it and it made so much sense. Lexington, Fayette County is perfectly situated for high-tech agriculture, and he knew this.
Mm-hmm.
And we have many cities don't have land. They're simply an urban area. We have land. We have a fantastic land-grant university with the College of Agriculture, Food and Environment. We have opportunities at Coldstream with our new economic development land. This year, we're going to be fully built out with our gigabit fiber, the entire urban area. And we're working toward being a 5G city. Dr. Lyons knew all this. So I've partnered with his son, Dr. Mark Lyons, with the dean of the College of Ag, with the commissioner of Ag at the state level, Ryan Quarles. And we are moving forward on this. We have met several times. We've had focus groups with the high-tech ag companies that are already here. And we now have hired a consultant who is going to help us move forward to attract these companies here. We're determined and we will do this. It's very important to our economy. It will give us another piece that is large. We've got the healthcare piece, we've got the university piece, the farming piece, the equine piece. We need to continue to diversify, and this will help us tremendously.
That's the kind of innovation that actually does create those new revenue streams that you need to fix the budget. So it has a very practical, fundamental meaning.
Absolutely.
Lexington Mayor Linda Gorton, thank you so much for taking time for us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here, Tom.
Coming up after the break,
it's good for society when women are in leadership roles.
And we begin a series on the event in American history that began making that happen. Ratification of the 19th Amendment 100 years ago. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
This week, we begin a year-long series celebrating 39 words.
The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall
not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state
on account of sex. Congress shall have power to enforce
this article by appropriate legislation.
Those 39 words, the 19th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, ratified 100 years ago, represent a milestone that came after a lengthy and difficult struggle, victory taking decades of agitation and protest. The sheer volume of brand new voters created by the amendment made it the single biggest democratizing event in American history. Our series of monthly interviews about this turning point in history and what has been or is yet to be achieved is researched and hosted by EKU Associate Professors Carolyn DuPont and Jackie Jay, and they're here today to give us a sense of what we'll hear in this monthly series throughout 2020. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'll start with you, Carolyn DuPont. The 19th Amendment was such a pivotal event in our history. What did it take, though, to get there, to achieve it?
Well, that is a question that I hope we can explore repeatedly in the coming year as we celebrate this milestone. But I think for today, it's probably best for our listeners just to think about the fact that this was in no way inevitable. There are so many points at which it could have stopped. We so often, when we look at historical events and we regard them as progress, we tend to sort of endow them with this idea that they were inevitable and that history always moves us forward. And that's just really not true. Sometimes history moves us back. And what we regard as gains are never inevitable. And I'd like to just read a little excerpt from Elaine Wise's The Woman's Hour.
Please do.
And we hope to have her on as part of this series. But she writes, "It's too easy to imagine that the enfranchisement of American women simply arrived, like some evolutionary imperative, a natural step in the gradual march of progress, or a gift eventually bestowed by wise men on their grateful wives, daughters, and sisters. But that's not how it happened." She goes on to say that winning the vote required 72 years of ceaseless agitation by three generations of dedicated, fearless suffragists who sought to overturn centuries of law and millennia of tradition concerning gender roles. The women who launched the movement were dead by the time it was completed. The women who secured its final success weren't born when it began. It took more than 900 local, state, and national campaigns involving tens of thousands of grassroots volunteers, financed by millions of dollars of mostly small and a few large donations by women across the country. So that just gives us a sense of the Herculean effort that so many people, most of them women, put into winning the right to vote.
What gains have been made in the centuries since ratification?
When we think about the course of the 20th century, that takes us from the 19th Amendment through World War II and Rosie the Riveter into the 1950s and the stereotypical housewife, and then the 1960s and the women's movement. I teach a class on the ancient world and modern cinema at EKU. And one of the things we look at is the movie Cleopatra with Liz Taylor that came out in 1963. And that really was on the cusp of the women's movement and the equal rights movement. And so things progressed and changed, and there still is a considerable way to go, I would say. My students grapple with that every day.
And if I could add to that,
sure.
And again, I'm drawing from Elaine Wise here, but she reminds us that women voting was not just a political achievement. It was also a social and cultural and moral debate and revolution in many ways. And it had the potential to upend so much about the way that our society is structured. So I think that we're still working to realize all the gains and to understand all the ways that this milestone has changed the United States.
Would either of you say that in the past decade or so, women have been arriving in leadership roles that prior to that time were dominated by men?
I think that's certainly the case. And I would say that one thing is that women are deciding that it's okay for them to be in leadership roles. And in fact, it's good for society when women are in leadership roles. And you know, there are certain fields where we saw this more quickly, and there are others where the gains are a little bit slower. For example, for a long time now, there have been more women than men as students in medical school. So women are entering the medical field in pretty similar numbers, but they haven't been choosing the professions of surgeon, for example, as often. Women have more often chosen, you know, pediatrics or dermatology. So the gains have been uneven, and I think the forces that dictate that are a little bit complex. A lot of this has to do with how we learn to think about ourselves. I think there are many ways that the culture teaches us how we may think about ourselves. And sometimes we have to grow into ideas of what we can and can do and be.
Let's talk a little bit about the imposition of domesticity on women prior to this and the expectation that a woman's life was consumed by domestic burden and chores. That's changed markedly, wouldn't you say? And maybe perhaps even being shared more evenly?
And when you look at the pre-modern world, it's important to remember that there was a much greater difference between rich and poor. And at the poor level, that domestic task, yes, you'd have women doing the cooking, doing the cleaning, looking after the kids, but men would be out in the fields and women would be out in the fields too, helping. Whereas the divisions in terms of power at the higher levels of society were much more marked. And with the Industrial Revolution, you see changes where instead of the agricultural society, people being tied to the fields, now people are beginning to go and work in factories. And in Victoria, England, you can think of the factory situation of men, women, and children being involved in that. But you start to see a divergence between careers and the idea of being a housewife developed at that point. And so it was with industrialization that shift became possible. And then with industrialization, you also see developments that make it possible for women to work outside of the home in that same way. The invention of the birth control pill was a pivotal change, and that modernized economy and industry also made that possible.
Okay, the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1920, and here we are 100 years later. And it's not at all unusual today for women to hold significant leadership roles in the realms of politics, in the corporate world, in community life. So gains have been made, but there still are achievements ahead. What would you identify as the most important obstacles to be overcome?
Well, let me comment first on the idea that it's not unusual to see women in leadership roles. And that is true. But I think that we want to celebrate progress, but also not overstate progress. For example, I was just looking at some numbers in the Kentucky legislature. And in fact, if I counted correctly, I believe there are 27 women in the Kentucky House of Representatives. Well, that's just 27%. And wow, that's a lot more than there used to be. But close to half the population of Kentucky is female. And it's not that we think that there has to be an exact duplication of that percentage, but 27%, you know, really isn't enough. So I think while we're much more comfortable, we don't want to celebrate too soon. And then you ask about obstacles. I think that there are a number of obstacles, but I think that one thing that is an obstacle is the ways that obligations of domesticity and family still impinge on women's lives and require sacrifices that they have to make in order to advance in their careers. And I think that we could do a better job in this country of making it possible, say, for working mothers. We're the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't guarantee paid parental leave after the birth of a child. And it's very hard to find childcare options for women who want to work. We could have policies that would support mothers and fathers staying home with their children. So I think that there are lots of obstacles that remain. And the most important thing we can do is raise our awareness and understand these obstacles.
What about wage or pay inequity?
It exists, but I don't know that I can pull off any stats just like that about what those inequities are. But we know that it exists. And, you know, some people will say, well, that's because women choose lower paying professions. But we have to look at the forces that are causing women to make those choices. The very subtle ways in which women's words and contributions are often less valued by our society. I think a good example of this is caregiving. Caregiving is such an important role, and all of us care for the people that we love for free, and we should. but when caregiving is a paid occupation, caring for the elderly, caring for children, it's usually a career choice or a work choice that is made by women. And it's very poorly compensated in this country. And I think, you know, I heard someone say, everybody has values and commitments. And look at where you put your time, look at where you put your thoughts, and look at where you put your money. And as a society, we have not demonstrated that we value caregiving by compensating it well.
Well, let's talk about this series that's coming up, because it's going to go for the entire year. It will be once a month, probably on the third Thursday of every month. And if you could share with us your plans for the series, who will you be featuring? What will we be talking about?
One thing I'm really excited about in this series is the fact that it's going to encompass race issues, the fact that white women and black women did not experience this struggle in the same way. And white women were often afraid of enfranchisement for black women because that would upset the status quo. Another thing that I think is important is that we'll be looking at the broader sweep. We have historians coming in who focus on the later part of the 19th century and then the early part of the 20th century. And I think many Americans will be able to think immediately of key individuals in the American women's struggle, like Susan B. Anthony, but putting those key figures into context and seeing the gradual progression of that struggle, I think, will be a key facet. Given the year that we're going into, 2020, it's important to recognize, I think, that democracy is not inevitable. The women's struggle and the fruition of that with the establishment of women's rights to vote was not an inevitability. Democracy itself is a very unusual thing in the history of the world. I study ancient history, and with my students, we look at ancient Athens, the world's first democracy, which was a crowning accomplishment, but was made possible only because citizens were granted the vote. Citizens were part of the democratic process, but those citizens were only men who were free, who had been born in Athens. Women, slaves, and foreigners were excluded. And so as democracy has evolved, we need to consider what that means to us. And one of our speakers, our next month's interview, will be with Dr. Josh Lin, who is one of our colleagues at EKU's Department of History, Philosophy, and Religious Studies. And he'll be looking at those changing notions of citizenship and democracy in the early American Republic to set the stage for what will follow.
So timely. Given the times that we're in now, I think we're all in search of as much perspective on how we got to where we are as we can get. So I'm really looking forward to that. Carolyn, you were going to add something to that?
I just to add that I think it's interesting that what it means to be a citizen, or even the concept of citizenship, is an evolving idea. When you think about it, the right to vote is not guaranteed in our Constitution. None of the first 10 amendments guarantees the right to vote. And so what did the framers of the Constitution think voting rights means with respect to civil rights or citizenship, or how much should they even think about that concept of citizenship? But we're going to save all of that for Dr. Lynn to unpack for us. But I'd also just like to add, in terms of looking to the events of the coming year, we've got some great events happening here at EKU. In March, we're going to be celebrating Women's History Month. And we always have a mini conference that we call the Her Story Conference rather than the History Conference. And we've got Dr. Sarah Egg from Center College, and I hope I'm pronouncing her name right, who researches Midwestern women and the fight for the right to vote. And so she'll be speaking to us in March and then giving a Chautauqua lecture in March at EKU. And we're going to repeat that with a similar event in September. And I can't unveil the speaker yet and all the various elements in that event because they're as yet unconfirmed, but that's going to be very exciting as well. And we've got really quite an array of scholars, politicians, and thinkers that are going to contribute to this conversation this year. So I think it's just going to be a marvelous exploration that's going to broaden the understanding of all of us, which is what we're really seeking here.
Well, we really look forward to being the platform for this. And thank you both so much for bringing it to Eastern Standard. We look forward to seeing what unfolds throughout the year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
EKU Associate Professor of American History Carolyn DuPont and Associate Professor of Ancient History Jackie Jay. Thank you. We look forward to each monthly installment of your series about the 19th Amendment establishing women's right to vote.
Women have been fighting for the legal right to vote since the 1840s. In 1890, the National American Women's Suffrage Association, NAWSA, was established with Susan B. Anthony its leading force. But women have been fighting for their rights since the very beginning of time. We couldn't dance, then said we couldn't drink. And unless a man allowed it, they said we couldn't think. They said we shouldn't speak till we were spoken to. Well, there was just so much back then we weren't allowed to do. But the first bite of that apple, I guess, revealed the truth. That's when Eve got smart, and that's why Adam don't like fruit. But that old tree of knowledge had some limbs that broke. We had to fight. They said we couldn't vote.
It is the duty of the women of this country to secure for themselves a sacred right to vote.
We carried signs, we cursed the times, marched up and down the streets. We had to fight for women's rights, wore blisters on our feet. We got tired of seeing all our dreams go up in smoke.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.fm or esweku.com. on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.